You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host for today, Hale, and with me, as so often we are together, is Brandon. But it turns out that we just incidentally have both been reading Hermann Hesse. And Hermann Hesse was a Swiss-German author born in the later 19th century and became quite a prominent and well-known writer. I believe he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1946, directly after the Second World War. A very well-known German author who wrote a lot of very philosophically charged novels. I would say that that is the big theme. They deal a lot with various philosophical topics, but especially those relating around kind of existential themes and psychoanalytic themes from that kind of school that he would have been very, you know, absorbed in, being a kind of intellectual in the late 19th century, early 20th century Europe. But also, very interestingly, Hermann Hesse was very, very interested in Eastern philosophy. And in fact, which I think is a very interesting thing to do, especially at the time, in the late 19th, early 20th century, traveled through Southeast Asia. Traveled through, I believe he went to India, places like Vietnam, Thailand. I'm not exactly sure where, but that he spent quite a number of years in East Asia, basically studying East Asian religions, philosophy, and that kind of thing. And that very clearly had a large impact on him and his work and the themes that he focuses on.
The one that we're mostly going to be discussing today is Demian. I have not read that one, but I, as it was saying, I have gotten a bit way through the Glass Bead Game, and I've also read Siddhartha a long while ago. So I'm familiar with Hermann Hesse as a Western writer of Eastern ideas, trying to bring those into the literary world in the West, encounter and explore different philosophical traditions, even trying to see Western ideas through a sort of cosmic Eastern perspective. But the other thing that I didn't realize was just how influenced he was by Jungian thought, which is a branch of psychoanalytic thought by Carl Jung, another German writer. In a certain way, I'm not surprised that Hesse would have been interested in Jung as well, considering that Jung himself also saw himself as corroborated by not just Eastern thought, but mythological thought in general, that these myths represent universal psychological constants.
He also, over the past decade of our kind of philosophical interest, he kind of became a pillar within like pop culture philosophy and psychology and stuff like that. Right? Everybody reads Jung, references Jung, blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. But I also know that Jung was very influenced and well-read in people like Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and stuff like that. Your sort of classic early, what we kind of would generally consider early existential thinkers. Yeah, so there's a lot of over-branching and overlapping of themes and ideas and these sorts of people. Many people would say that Nietzsche is one of the first psychoanalysts in the way that he kind of dissects and understands the individual and all that kind of stuff. Not going to comment on whether or not that is the case, but there's a lot of sort of the sort of intellectual soup, this sort of like mixture of kind of late 19th century existential psychological and Eastern thought, like kind of souping around, that was really much, very much a thing. Hesse is very much a major figure in that world. He's someone who kind of took that whole theme, that collective, and turned it into very, very well-known and respected works of literature at this point.
He was quite popular in his own time, but his works had a certain revival after his death and the emergence of counterculture in the West. That's especially where his literature is picked up and read.
Hess became really big. Like, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1946 when, you know, he was still alive. He died, like you said, he died in 1962. He was born in, like, 1877. So, you know, like, the counterculture stuff was, he was a very old man when that started to kind of show up just very early on the scene. But after he died, his work became very popular with the sort of, for lack of a better way of saying it, hippie, spiritual kind of, you know, self-discovery, the New Age self-discovery movement, right? Books like Siddhartha, Stefan Wolf. There's actually a band, like a rock band that became quite popular called Stefan Wolf, but, you know, they're named after Hess's novel, and Demian as well. And actually, interestingly for our listeners, my copy of Demian, and I don't know about Stefan Wolf, but both Demian and Siddhartha are quite short. They're more like novellas. On the front, it says, there's a quote from a reviewer that says, "Such dispassionate lucidity and fearless honesty." And that quote is from Dr. Timothy Leary. On the back, he said about Hess, "Few writers have chronicled with such dispassionate lucidity and fearless honesty the progress of the soul through the states of life." Dr. Timothy Leary. And if those of you don't know, Timothy Leary was a sort of cultural figure, intellectual leader in the kind of far fringe of the more, like, what was the saying, drop in, drop out.
So it's not just about, you know, being a stoner. I think that that's definitely how it was applied. But for him, it's a kind of three-step program to becoming more spiritually inclined. It's about turning in towards yourself, tuning into the world, and dropping out sort of gracefully of forced institutions or structures that you don't agree with. It's not just about, you know, but in any case, I think that more or less that's how your interpretation is how most people interpret it.
Well, I was going to say, there I go continuing to propagate the misinterpretations of, like, of the man, for lack of a better way of saying it. But basically a philosophical approach or a research method that focuses more on studying the subjective conscious experience or the being of something, like how something is as it is. Right now, there's always going to be this back and forth. Like, some people want to have them more like it's studying the subjective consciousness, almost psychological experience, as he's come up many times on the show before. Someone like Heidegger is going to completely kind of deny that and be like, no, you want to kind of completely remove this sort of whole idea of the psychologism of this sort of thing and talk about, like, the being there, just like what it is as itself, presented in itself. You know, that's where you get that kind of interesting layered language. But we wanted to do a little bit of a phenomenological study, or at least look at a little bit of a phenomenological study of an interesting period that most, basically everyone will go through, and that is focused on particularly in the beginning of Demian, and that is the transition that people go through in figuring out kind of who they are out of childhood, right? So transitioning basically from childhood to adulthood and how one understands oneself before, during, and after that process, if you can even split it up like that. And what childhood as an experience at the time, and also as a reflective mechanism that people continue to look back on, means to individuals in their day-to-day lives. Demian, like, I'm not going to get, like, super into the whole story of the book, but the main character, Emil, at least in the first portion, basically goes through this transition, right? The kind of seal of childhood, the sanctity of childhood, is very clearly constructed for him, and then it's very much broken. And how does someone deal with that? I'm going to look for a quote. Is there anything that you wanted to bring up or say on the subject?
I think specifically on the subject of phenomenology, that it's interesting, right? Phenomenology does emerge out of philosophy. Specifically, it's a method trying to overcome sort of dead ends in metaphysics that Edmund Husserl is innovating. But it more or less, since it's discovered to be a method and is not, and is attempting not to be a school of philosophy, it gets applied to a lot of things. Like, I've talked with nursing students who resonate when I start talking about phenomenology, because they learn phenomenology in nursing. You have to be able to attend to a patient's experience. It's about, it essentially is a way of taking experiences seriously in a way that philosophy had not previously. It's about taking subjective experience as a datum, as a given, and not analyzing it in terms of categories or trying to situate it within a framework, but to explicate the what it's likeness of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was going to say what it is like to be X, right? I think is the most important thing. So in this case, we're using Demian as a sort of jumping off or example to sort of discuss what is it like to transition at of or for this sort of world, for what this one world to sort of decay and, you know, potentially another open. How does one relate to that? And it's going to look different for different people, but the idea a lot of times is going to be certain themes. I want to say, I always like to say with the what it is likeness sort of topic, one of my favorite papers to bring up, although it's actually not, it's actually a philosophy of mind paper, really, but one of my favorite papers to kind of illustrate this, that kind of hints at this issue and how problematic it can be to even talk about, is Thomas Nagel's What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And while this paper isn't actually a phenomenology paper, really, what it highlights in Thomas Nagel's paper, another one for listeners, What Is It Like to Be a Bat, is really easily accessible and can be found online if you're interested in reading. It's a classic. But basically, Nagel writes that there is a way that bats experience life, that experience their existence, that we can never know. It doesn't matter how many tests we perform. It doesn't matter how much data we collect. Right. It doesn't matter if we even find a way to stick like a pot on my head and transition my consciousness into that of a bat's body, because ultimately it will just be me flying around like a bat, but I won't actually be living that bat's life. Right. There's a very specific, unique way that bats live that we just can't know about. Right. And it's that sort of version of being like or being there that we're most concerned with phenomenology. Right. Which I guess is why you can't do the phenomenology of, you know, a bat or a snail's life. It's just not really, you know, you could do the phenomenology of study of those sorts of things, the phenomenology of doing biology or whatever.
I mean, I think you can, but that would take us a bit far afield because I have criticisms of Thomas Nagel.
For sure.
That's not what we're talking about today. Metaphors are pretty good for bridging gaps. That's literally what they're for. But in any case, that's what poets do, right?
I want to just start off with a quote right actually from the prologue where Emil, our main character, is discussing what it is to be a person, even before we get to childhood, what that means. But he says, every man is not only himself. He is also the unique, particular, always significant, and remarkable point where the phenomena of the world intersect once and for all and never again. That is why every man's story is important, eternal, and sacred. In each individual, the spirit is made flesh. In each one, the whole of creation suffers. In each one, a savior is crucified. He goes on to say, few people nowadays know what man is. Many feel it intuitively and die more easily for that reason. And then he goes on to say, the life of every man, in a way, is a way to himself, an attempt at a way, the suggestion of a path. No man has ever been utterly himself, yet every man strives to be so, the dull, the intelligent, each one as best he can. So I think it's that I wanted to bring up an open quote actually from the prologue of the work, because it kind of highlights in a phenomenological study the subjective nature of each individual's experience that is always already going to be recognized in any sort of phenomenology that we do, right? Even if we can talk broadly about, which we will, the sacred world of childhood that we're going to be talking about, there's always each one of those, you know, things that makes up that class or category, which we're trying to, in a way, annihilate phenomenology. The sort of recognition is that each one is actually going to be kind of unique. It's going to be its own effective painting with its own brush strokes and its own movements that will always be this kind of special placement of things built up in just a particular way that will then evaporate and never be put together just that way again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like this. It's interesting. I think I brought up this quote from Nietzsche when we were discussing Michael Ignatieff and this idea of a fixed human nature. I think here Hermann Hesse is simply putting on the table that he does not, or at least the novel that he's writing, is not predicated upon a fixed human nature. Each person is an individual. They have their particular ways of experiencing the world by virtue of their occurring once and only once. And in this rejection of the idea of, so the Nietzsche quote, man does not progress, he does not even exist. Everyone else is so concerned with figuring out what man is and then idealizing it and then living up to it, all the while completely ignoring their own particularity as a human. So as Arendt would say, men, not man, lives on the earth. Plurality is the law of the earth. We each bring something to the table by virtue of our birth in some way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't want to hesitate too much from getting into any kind of like cultural criticism, whatever, but I do think it's, you know, it's something that I encounter regularly in my own life. Is a 30, I've just turned 30, unfortunately, and everyone else is like such a big number. Hooray, I'm like, oh my God. It's, you know, there's this impulse, there's this pull for, you know, like you say, like it's more about men than man, but yet there's this pull for so many people to relate to and understand themselves within the reflection of man, or like, you know, if we're going to get Das Man or like the they, in the sense of we have this projection, this category of person, right? Man, what is that supposed to be? And just like Hesse is actually saying here within the context of a particular, always significant, remarkable, always significant, remarkable point where phenomena of the world intersect once and for all and never again. You know, and this phenomena of the world is always going to be a little bit different depending on where you are, when you are, also determinative of who you are, obviously, right? But it's, I was saying, the point that I even see with people I interact with is there's this pull, like I'm supposed to be a particular way. I'm also 30 years old and I'm supposed to have this kind of job making this much money and I'm supposed to be in this sort of position and et cetera, et cetera. And it's like that impetus, that call to that particular kind of duty isn't like a real thing. There is no like centralized man that sort of gravitationally pulls everyone in a point they're supposed to be. There's many kinds of ways of being, and it just depending on where and when you are, the sort of phenomena that you deal with, there's more or less normalized ways of interacting in the world.
Yeah, I think the right word there is normalized, considering that there's an enormous variation of ways that people do go about things, but at the same time, our real experience of the world still is something like a socially stable substratum. Like we have concepts and terms for communicating with each other about social expectations, even though we are all these fonts of spontaneity, we still navigate these things in these ways. I think it's interesting too, bringing up you bring up the concept of Das Man, or the they, as Heidegger would translate, or as some would translate Heidegger's term, this idea of a sort of indefinite person, or an indefinite, like a social indefinitude out of which we kind of emerge and become individuated out of. But I think it's actually a really good, I think it's one of the more like strikingly phenomenological, like, 'cause the term specifically is iterated in being and time, which is predicated upon all kinds of phenomenological evidence. We're drawing on Demian here for our phenomenological evidence. But one of the more compelling phenomena is the they, and I see it compelling in so far as the they is not just something out there, but it's something that is always potentially us as well. I don't know if you've ever had this experience. I don't know if you've ever had this experience of like you say you have like a friend and you know them in their particularity and they are an articulated individual in your world, but they just start doing things and they just lose their self in them. You know, they start, I don't know, they start like, they just get into a band or something. They get really into like a band and it just like starts consuming them and they stop being themselves and just become this indefinite person obsessed with this thing. I think this is just that by way of example, these are the kinds of ineffable phenomena that phenomenology want to take seriously. The things that are really interesting, the things that we can't talk about, but the things that we all understand because we've all had experiences like this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's the Das Man, you know, I think, like, this is as an aside, this is something we've talked about before on the show, but like, what does it mean to be an authentic individual? There's this sort of like caricaturized existential version, which is this like totally free walking, authentic being, you know, this sort of self-discovered Übermensch type character or whatever. Obviously that seems like a fantasy and is totally absurd. And the, at least to me, and the much more authentic and real version of understanding oneself that is found actually in, you know, I think we might even cross over it in Demian a little bit here, is recognizing the structure or the world that one is absorbed in and taking account of who one is and what one wants to do for oneself within that contextual framework, within that forest, rather than thinking that someone can eject themselves from the scenario. Right. Somehow.
Yeah.
You know, if only it was the whole thing.
Yeah. If only I was in a different set of circumstances, or only if things had gone differently, stuff like that. Authenticity is sort of rooted in a conscious awareness of where one is and responding to it. The phenomena of authenticity, just that's its conditions.
And since we're speaking about those conditions, if we come back to Demian, first chapter, an opening of a discussion of him, Demian, reflecting upon the world of the phenomena that he inhabits in his childhood world. This is what I said, I'll kind of read through this section here. So this is, I think, really important for our discussion and gives a really good sense of what childhood meant, at least for him and people like him. I can still catch the fragrance of many things which stir me with feelings of melancholy and send delicious shivers of delight through me. Dark and sunlit streets, houses and towers, clock chimes and people's faces, rooms full of comfort and warm hospitality, rooms full of secret and profound ghostly fears. It is a world that savors of warm corners, rabbits, servant girls, household remedies, and dried fruit. It was the meeting place of two worlds, day and night came thither from the two opposite poles. So he's talking already, it should be noted, as a child, within the context of the book, there's a world of day and a world of night. His childhood is very much inhabited in the world of day, although it is not unawares of the world of night. It's not as if it knows, those two worlds are always kind of self-aware of each other. He's just, as a child, Demian's childhood is always, at least until that kind of, we'll talk about the seal is broken, it is firmly in that world of good. So this is the world of Day he's going to talk about a bit here. There was the world of my parents' house, or rather, it was even more circumcised and embraced only by my parents themselves. This world was familiar to me in almost every aspect. It meant mother and father, love and severity, model behavior and school. It was a world of quiet brilliance, clarity, cleanliness, in it gentle and friendly conversation, washed hands, clean clothes, and good manners were the order of the day. In this world, the morning hymn was sung, Christmas was celebrated. Through it ran straight lines and paths that led into the future. Here was duty and guilt, bad conscience and confessions, forgiveness and good resolutions, love and reverence, wisdom and Bible readings. In this world, you had to conduct yourself so that life should be pure, unsullied, beautiful, and well-ordered. So that's really Demian giving, or sorry, Emile, but Hess writing about Emile as Emile, giving a reflection of what his childhood world meant to him, right? Now, obviously, again, Hess wrote this book, and I think this book's kind of, from the reading it, I suspect it's set in kind of late 19th century Germany. So, again, a very conservative, Christian, family-oriented, small German town, right? He comes from a upper middle-class background where, you know, the family is very close, things are very safe, things are very Christian, things are very mannerly, things are very structured, regimented, oriented. And it's kind of like a little Protestant heaven, right? Like a little child, like, you know, in a way, you know, it's not like it's totally unfun, but it's very formal and very, like I said, it's, I think safe is a word, but also not particularly adventurous. One is already, I like the line where he says clear paths to the future. Like you living in this world as if things are already meted out for you, how things will go, right? If you follow, if you live in this life and you live in this world, there's no risk and there's no adventure. There's no kind of unseen. Things are going to play out in a particular way, like they have for people for generations. It's going to be all good and safe and spiritual in the right way. And that would be like the world, very much the world of light for us.
Yeah, it's good that you preface this by saying that Emile's world is the world of Day. But at the same time, it is conspicuous. Like, I think it was good that you said that at the same time, I think Emile is aware of the night. The night is not in the world of the day yet. It's a sort of like flurry of images and examples and structures. None of them actually instantiate any kind of solidness or dirtiness or anything that would sort of impinge upon, I mean, the key word here is innocence in a certain way, right? Like, I'm thinking specifically, it's one thing for a child to exist in a safe world and exist in a structured world and an ordered world. But at the same time, children are, and I mean, people are when they're being childlike, but they're spontaneous, right? They can't know in advance of what they're doing. The safety comes from the capacity to be spontaneous in this setting, right? And nothing that I'm saying that could be interpreted as dirty, because we, like, people say things and they don't know what's coming out of them, right? I remember I had this interesting moment when I was a kid where I was drawing patterns and I was just doodling, right? And I was drawing a cross. I drew like a T and I added four little lines to each of the ends of it. And my mom, she saw it and said, "Brandon, that's a bad symbol. Don't draw that." I drew a swastika. I didn't know what that was in advance of it. I was experimenting visually, right? So this is a world where stuff like that